on this episode of Optimal Health Uncovered.
Yeah, I think the key word you said there is adaptation. You know, you have to apply some kind of stress to your body. Your body adapts to that stress and becomes stronger.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode. Todd, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Michael. How are you?
Doing well. Good to have you back in the studio.
Glad to be here.
Good. So today we're going to talk about stress and how you're my biggest stressor in life.
No, good.
Kidding. So let's just jump right in. How's your stress level today?
My stress level today is a little bit more elevated than normal, but it's good. I'm managing it.
That's good. So how would we define stress? Let's have a conversation around that.
Well, stress can be good or bad, you know. It's perception a lot of times, and then how your body reacts to it, you know, how your nervous system responds and all the other systems within your body. And, you know, I think from a perspective of people understanding stress, when they usually come in, they're talking about the negative form of stress. You know, they're stressed with their job, they're stressed in a relationship, financial stress, et cetera. I like to think of it in my life as balancing the negative stress with the positive stresses that I can apply in the body or somehow how I offset that. And that's obviously our model of performance optimal health. So I think we'll dig into that a little bit as we get into the podcast here, but I always look at it as the balance. I'm okay with stress. I accept it. I know that it's normal and natural. Some people get really stressed out. Freak out about it. And it's our job to help them manage it.
Yeah. I think it's a good synopsis of everything. Stress is normal, right? The stressors that we have every day are normal, you know, stimuli that we face. So from an exercise standpoint, if you didn't stress your body, you would die, right? So if there's no stress, there's no stimulus, cardiovascular, you'd decline, muscles would atrophy, your bones would wither away, right? So stress could just be the stress of getting up, walking around and being active. That's actually a normal stress. It's a positive stress. When it becomes problematic, you know, you could be over-exercising and injury and breakdown could occur. Same thing can happen mentally. If you're not challenging yourself mentally and you're just kind of staring at a screen all day and not really thinking or critically problem solving, not enough stress is going into it, right? No neuroplasticity, as we kind of medically call it. And if you're overstressed, then you can break down. It could be anything from a headache to a migraine to just, you know, literally emotional breakdown. So stress isn't always bad. We tend to talk of it as a negative, but I think it's important to highlight that in the absence of stress, we, you know, cease to exist. Stress is a necessary thing.
So with that said, let's break it down into its components. You spoke of exercise. Let's talk about a positive stress in exercise and a negative stress in exercise. What do you think of?
I think an easy example is cardiovascularly. So when you stress your cardiovascular system, there's positive adaptations, right? Your heart rate goes up while you're exercising, but then you've watched that over time at rest, your heart rate actually comes down. You have a lower resting heart rate. So your heart's not functioning. It's not stressed as much during just the day-to-day life demands, right? So someone who's deconditioned usually gets winded going up the stairs. They're training for a little bit. They no longer get winded going up the stairs. So positive stress is blood pressure could come down. So that's an easy way to look at it. Muscles, right? So if someone is starting out and they've never exercised before, they may have low muscle tone or no muscle tone or high deposition of fat. You stress with the proper exercises, you could see the, you know, adaptations occur week to week. If you're looking in the mirror where you're getting a little bit more muscle bulk, you're losing fat, looking a bit leaner. So I think it's easy from an exercise standpoint to visualize.
Yeah. I think the key word you said there is adaptation. You know, you have to apply some kind of stress to your body. Your body adapts to that stress and becomes stronger, and you're able to tolerate more, whether it's cardiovascular or strength, et cetera.
Yeah, and we've talked about this on previous podcasts, like sauna and cryo, like how those are stressors, right? Those stressors work because it's that process medical science calls hormesis, where you're exposed to stimuli over and over again and your body positively adapts to that. If it's too much or it's too aggressive, it can negatively adapt to that, but it's not enough. It's the same thing. So there's, you know, the SED principle, something we all learned in PT school or exercise physiology school, acronym, you know, specific adaptations to imposed demands. So if you're getting imposed demands that are appropriate, you're going to adapt positively. If they're inappropriate, either too high or too low, you're going to adapt negatively.
That's a key point as well. A lot of good stuff from you today, man. We're talking about adaptability, and now you're talking about specific adaptation and amount of stress. I love it.
Well, working with you, you know, you have to learn to deal with stress on a regular basis and adapt. So you've prepared me in my career to do this pretty well.
So to pick up on your point of the right amount of stress, So exercise, like you said, you got to have an exercise program that's going to stress your body enough so you make gains and your body adapts. And how does one determine what that right amount is? Because we know a lot of people who come in where the reason they find us is because they've injured themselves because they stress the body too much with exercise. So what do you recommend, you know, whether it's preventative or restorative after they're already injured to help an individual find that right balance?
I think once they're already injured, they'd already overcome the physiologic response of that tissue. So say you take a fracture, right? So your bone can only take on so much stress before it fractures, right? So if you're heliskiing and you're jumping down, your bindings, you know, you catch an edge, your bindings don't break. The stress that goes through that bone is higher than the bone can tolerate, and you've already kind of overcome that. So if they're coming to us injured, they've already gone beyond the stress capacity of whatever tissue is injured. So that's that situation. So how do I know as a therapist, as I'm progressing them through their program, you know, there's certain principles of healing that we can follow. So like, you know, soft tissue in general, it's a generalization. You know, we say 6 to 8 weeks of soft tissue healing, but really remodeling that tissue can go on for 9 months to a year from what some of the studies will show. So if we're looking at, say, that fracture, we'll stay with that example. You know, we're looking at how much, kind of a stepwise process, how much can that stress going to tolerate to remodel and reshape into the right type of bone. So with the fracture in that example, you want callus formation. So if you're non-wapering because of fracture, you're on crutches, when the doctor clears you and when they think you're ready to it, maybe 2-3 weeks into it, you may be weight bearing. So we would run them through a progressive weight bearing. So the stress that we're putting through that bone is causing, without being too scientific, causing the bone to adapt in a positive way. If we never did anything and they were immobilized forever, the moment that bone would essentially die, the moment we would put that foot back on the ground, refracture would occur, right? They would lose bone mineral density, et cetera. So then we progress it to adding the right type of exercises on top of that. Muscles actually pull on that bone, and that's going to generate some healing. So in that example, we would take them from non-wapering all the way to maybe a return to activity or sport. It could be a 6-month process, and there's certain principles of healing. Then there's the feel factor where we're implementing with a logical exercise that feels right. The science says it's right. And then we kind of have to reevaluate to say, okay, how did you feel after last time? So the day-to-day stresses of, okay, how did I feel after my exercise? Did I feel sore? Good. That means you have some positive adaptations. Was it excessively sore? Were you unable to get out of bed? Did it last for 5 days instead of the typical, you know, 24 to 48 hours, right? So for me, you know, if I'm working out, I should feel stress afterwards. I should feel that delayed onset muscle soreness if I'm doing the right things, if that's what I'm training for. And if I'm not, maybe I didn't push it hard enough. If my goal is to regenerate tissue and grow in terms of muscle size, right? If I'm training for a marathon, you know, cardiovascularly, you want your response to improve. So you should be able to have more endurance capacity as you're training. There's metrics that you can utilize, whether it be with wearables or with, you know, a heart rate strap where you're looking at your cardiovascular response as you're training. You should kind of hit steady state where the stressors that used to take you to a high heart rate level, maybe it was 2 miles, now you're doing 20 miles and you're pretty much at that steady state where you're kind of in the sweet spot where it's not overtaxing you. So long-winded answered, but I think, you know, from a rehab standpoint, we have a lot more science behind it. From an exercise standpoint, there's a good amount of science behind it, but there's also that feel of kind of engaging with your clients and seeing on the day-to-day how they're responding.
Yeah, great answer. So if I synthesize that, it would be if you've overloaded and you're injured, you probably need health guidance from a healthcare professional, physician, you know, physical therapist, chiropractor, some kind of guidance on how to allow that tissue to properly heal and apply appropriate stress so it's as strong as it needs to be. From an exercise basis, you did a good job bringing it home to say, you know, you want to have some overload. You want to have a little bit of discomfort and damage to the muscle so it can rebuild. You just don't want to overload it to the point where it breaks down excessively and then you go into damage control. So that was a good way to wrap that all up. Let's switch gears and go to, you had mentioned sauna, and there's other, you know, modalities that we can use that apply stress on the body. And like you said, hormesis, trying to apply a stress to the body so the body adapts. Talk about things that you use in clinical practice or, you know, that are out there where the public may need to, you know, have a little bit more guidance on exactly why they're used. And, you know, I think, you know, most people think, oh, sauna, it feels great. I'm sweating. I'm getting rid of the toxins. But a lot of times it's more than just relieving toxins from your body. So can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So I'm staying with that example. So exposure to heat is going to have certain positive physiologic responses. So one of them is cardiovascularly. You're going to respond, so your heart rate goes up as you're under a load, a demand of higher heat, right? And what happens over time is your blood pressure ends up coming down, right? So short term, it's that sympathetic nervous system. I'm in extreme heat, or conversely, I'm in extreme cold. I'm in fight or flight mode. What happens thereafter is where that magic or that secret sauce is where your parasympathetic nervous system, your rest, digest, recovery system kicks in. And that creates a lot of positive adaptations around that. So cardiovascularly, you'll actually have a lower heart rate, stroke volume, blood pressure will come down if you repeatedly expose yourself to sauna in kind of a dose-dependent manner, meaning the more you do it, the more positive adaptations you'll have. Cryo is similar. So I remember, you know, we had Mike Ranfone is one of the trainers that we have a good relationship with. I remember taking one of his courses a while back, and he put it in a really good context. Now, it doesn't matter what discipline you come from, like whether you're a physical therapist, personal trainer, chiropractor, you know, in our area of medicine, all we do is we dose something. We dose stress. We affect somebody's sympathetic nervous system. We affect somebody's parasympathetic nervous system. So the appropriate amount of stress, irrespective of the modality, whether it be my hands as a physical therapist, someone else's hands as a chiropractor, or the dosing of exercise as a personal trainer, could have a positive effect, and you could be the best trainer, chiropractor, or physical therapist in the world, or it could have a negative effect, and you could be, you know, a bad PT, right? So if you're just adapting to stresses positively because you know how to dose it, it doesn't really matter the medium. I think we tend to overcomplicate things and kind of over science things a little bit and gets too scientific. You know, all we do is we impose stresses on individuals to create positive adaptations. If too much stress, it's bad. If it's too little stress, it's bad. The sweet spot's in the middle, and that's where the results come from.
And I agree. And it's educating, basically, individuals on what the right dose amount is. And our job as professionals, in whatever that discipline is to kind of guide the individual and, you know, and find out where the stress loads are in their life and whether they're enough, and or whether we need to push the gas a little bit more with some of these, the loads that they're applying, you know, in the end to achieve the goals they want to achieve.
And then if you're a non-clinician, you're just a human being, like, how do you know that you're stressing your body enough or not enough? So I think we talked about the exercise piece, but just the life stress. So if you're sleeping poorly, if you're having bad relationships, right, and you're angry at people all the time, or you're depressed and there's emotional signs, you're probably not managing stress appropriately and need somebody to help you with it, right? Meditation apps, applications on your phone, right? iPhone, Android, whatever. Downloading those and kind of working through them, being mindful, getting in a room, kind of just being quiet away from, you know, everything can be a stressor. Like literally the lights that are on us right now are pulsing at a frequency and they're stressing our nervous system without us even knowing it. And then you add in cell phones and everything. So there's a lot of stress that's thrown at us every day that we don't appreciate. So just spending time away from that. If individuals are listening and did nothing else, just getting away from that for 10 minutes a day will help.
I completely agree. And, you know, the last 5 years, I've really kind of dug into all the different apps like you've spoken about, you know, whether it's a Calm app, a Muse app, a 10% happier, when you're talking about meditation type apps. You know, I think it's great that we have this variety to choose from, because everyone has different releases for their stress. And I think the way you manage it is you got to be comfortable with that. It's like finding the right exercise for you. Well, which type of exercise do you like? Find that. The same thing with the apps or the breathing or breath work, whether it's an app that gets you there, or whether it's just going for a walk outside, nature helps you, whether it's just singing, whether it's, you know, sitting in a quiet room,
journaling,
writing. Yeah.
Correct. A lot of good science for that.
So I think people just need to understand that there's a lot of ways out there that you can really reduce your stress load. I think you first have to kind of take a look at what is your stress load. And, you know, if you can't recognize it, maybe talk to a professional who can help you recognize the amount of stress. Cause a lot of times people don't realize the stress. Like you had mentioned, sleep, and I know food, and, you know, overall stress at home, there's multiple factors. It's not just usually one thing that's leading to your stress. And I kind of say this to my wife and I'll laugh about it and I'll probably get in trouble later, but it's like, she'll be yelling about something and she's saying she's stressed about it when the stressor really came a day before or hours before, and it was something else that was the trigger. And then the stress was compounding because, okay, the kids are home from school, or you've got to do this, that wasn't on your schedule. And then those things add up. I know in my life, like I got a routine. If something comes into the routine, that's stressful to me, whereas it shouldn't be. So coping that I've used is just to say, acknowledge that, okay, this is happening. Is it life or death? Not really. So is everything okay? Am I going to survive? And then kind of breathing into it. You know, I think everyone manages a little differently. Had an interesting, I was out on a walk this weekend and listened to a book on tape. And then my daughter texts me. She's down in Florida. And we spoke that she's down there training. And she's like, text me. These kids today text instead of calling. Dad, we're in a car accident. We were T-boned. I'm like, oh no, right? I'm like, parents, last thing the parents want to hear. Well, I'm kind of glad she texts and not a police officer or someone else. She's like, we're okay. I'm like, no, get on the phone right now. But I didn't panic at all about it, right? And I just spoke to her. I'm like, okay, is everyone okay? What's the process? How did you handle it? I'm going to do this. She gave me the directions on what she was doing. I stayed calm. And then I finished my walk for another 20 minutes. She's like, just don't tell mom because mom will freak out. So her reaching out to me, knowing that the way I would manage a stress versus the way, say, my wife might, or the way I may have handled that in the past 5 years ago would have been completely different. Yeah. So just understanding the situation. So a lot of times it's your perception of the stress. And is it something that's immediate that this is an emergency, I need to kick the fight or flight in and react? Or is it something that I can absorb, accept, and then kind of work through?
Yeah, so. I think it's important. That's really, well, I'm glad they're okay. That's number one. But I think it's an important thing to note that like our nervous systems are our nervous systems, and they've been that way since the dawn of humankind, right? So back in the day when we were being chased by tigers, like that response is the same response that could happen when your kids call you and or text you and say that they've been in a car accident. So that fight or flight response kicks in. We now have the cognitive capacity, and luckily outside of maybe some zoo incidents, we're not being chased by tigers, to say, okay, so I could actually quell that fight or flight response, but it's the same physiologic response. If it's studied in a laboratory, and it has been, or whether you're being attacked and you know you're fearful of your life, or there's just a stressor of some email that comes in from work, we respond the same way. Our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, our breathing rate goes up, right? So we have control of that. And the way to really hack into that, the easiest way is, you know, breathing, right? So if nothing else, if you're finding yourself overwhelmed with life stressors, take some time just to breathe. Then when you're breathing, you're calming down. And then you can think, okay, this isn't life or death. And then you can kind of rationalize around it. And if you're having a tough time doing that throughout the workday, one thing that's worked for me is like, I'm an appointment driven person, especially in our career. Like you have, I'm not on time for my 9 o'clock appointment, and throws my 10 o'clock appointment off, so on and so forth, right? So I dedicate those times to my patients. But then in my personal life, I wasn't really carving out time as much as I needed to. Like exercise, I always did before work, so that worked. But then when kids came into the equation, things get muddy. Actually putting things on my calendar that are important to me and my health actually makes an accountability on my end to say, okay, that's just like an appointment with one of my patients. I can't be late for my 9 o'clock breathing session or sauna session. So when I work with clients and talk about accountability, that's one thing I say, put it, whatever calendar you use. I use Outlook, right? Using your Apple calendar, whatever it may be, just say, put that on your schedule so that when that happens, you're not just going to plug in another meeting, or you're not going to plug in another stressor. You're actually going to spend time dedicating that to de-stressing, right? And the work from home, we talked about it with Ashley on the podcast, I think 2 weeks ago. You know, work from home has been great to keep people safe from COVID. But what started out as, hey, I had 2 hours that I gained from my commute and I filled it with exercise, has now become, for most of my clients, now I just know that I could have meetings from almost the moment I wake up to the moment I go to bed. And everyone knows that there's no commute, so we just jam pack. So I would encourage those people, and that's what I do in clinical practice, to say, okay, carve out 30 minutes to exercise, carve out midday, pretend like you have a meeting, but it's just with yourself and you're going doing some meditation or just going for a walk, getting the hell outside, doing that. And that having it on the calendar, I think, has been the biggest life changer for me when it comes to stuff like this.
I completely agree. And I do the same thing. And I encourage my clients to do the same thing. If it's on there and it becomes part of your routine and the time you're committing to yourself, you're basically, you're helping yourself improve, which is going to help you as you deal with your family or stress at work, et cetera. So I think that's definitely something that I'm doing more as well. And I find it very beneficial. So let's switch gears and talk about another type of stress. And we kind of talk about our four pillars. And one of our pillars is nutrition. you know, I always tell clients food can be a good stress to your body or a bad stress. You know, the good stress is the food you choose, you know, fruits, vegetables, well hydrated, watch excessive intake of sugar, salt, excessive, depending on where they are, who they are, how their body's wired. And then, you know, we often think, you know, we have an obesity issue in the United States, you know, 40%+ of the population is obese or overweight. And that's the bad stress when we're eating things that are actually putting a lot of strain on our body. How do you approach this with clients? Because, you know, obviously our training is in physical therapy and we have a baseline working knowledge of nutrition. How do you decide, you know, when you're just going to have that conversation and what kind of advice do you give people on food and when do you take it to the next level to really take it up the line to one of our nutritionists?
Yeah. I mean, I think just listening is where I would start to see, okay, are they fueling their body appropriately for what they're requiring of their body, right? So are they underfueling? Are they overfueling? Are they eating enough calories? Are they eating too little calories? Of the calories they're getting, are they nutrient dense? Is it whole foods or is it kind of junk foods? Is it green leafies and a lot of good fruits and vegetables with a little lean protein? Or is it standard American diet, high carbs, high sugar, and saturated fats? Like the simple stuff, I think it's common knowledge now. So that's my line. Like my line is, okay, I am maybe a little bit more educated than some, but not as educated as, you know, our excellent clinical nutritionists and dietitians on staff and out there in the community. So my line is always, okay, is this person under that bar where I can just kind of get them up to that bar to say, okay, how are you feeling? How are the metrics? How's your blood panel looking? Have you talked to your GP? Kind of work through that with them. And if they're there and they still need help and you know, it's beyond my scope, that's kind of where I would refer. So that's kind of the line for me. I think just hearing them out, if there's somebody who's coming in for pain and inflammation are pretty linked. And if I'm doing everything right on the therapy side, they're doing everything right from exercise management or allowing the tissue to heal and repair, yet they're still in pain, they're still inflamed. Usually that's a sign that there's something missing, right? So then I then start digging into nutrition or along this course, I'm digging into nutrition. They may have a good diet, but maybe they have some intolerance to certain foods, right? And that's another area where I'd have somebody intervene. You know, nightshade vegetables, things like that, that can be more pro-inflammatory, depending on the individual, different intolerances. So I think food and inflammation are paired together and it's becoming more commonplace. And then just gut health and that whole end of things, which is a dark hole that I don't go into because I think people who do it really well in terms of managing gut and microbiome, they still are kind of struggling to understand it. And there's no consistency or consensus on what's that. So I don't touch that, but you know, that's where I would kind of refer. If someone's eating everything healthy, but they don't seem like they're absorbing the nutrients because they're continuously breaking down, I would look at the gut and say, okay, maybe that's something that you should talk to a specialist about. And that's kind of where I draw the line with that. But easily, you know, wearables has shed some light on this, even for me, like eating really healthy. And I try to continue to eat really healthy, but based on my schedule, I do eat too close to bed sometimes. And it definitely affects, you know, my sleep scores. So having some type of metric to say like, here's how this stress is physiologically affecting you. Your heart rate didn't settle until 2 p.m., but you're up at 5 p.m., right?
Yeah.
I'm up at 4, right? So I didn't settle, you know, as soon as I needed to. My heart rate variability was off, right? So that's like the best thing to show somebody who's like, man, I'm doing all the right things, or I don't think snacking really affects me. It's like, no, show them. And there's, whether it be Apple Watch or otherwise, there's soon everyone's going to have something on their body that's going to show them that.
I like how you tied in the eating and the sleep, because that's an avenue I always take. And, you know, when you have the data to kind of show you where your heart rate is or your HRV and the eating too close, I stop eating at 5:30, 6 o'clock now, probably 5-6 days a week. I feel so much better. I sleep much better. Hormonally, you're balanced through the day. I find that, you know, my body's not working overtime to digest the food. I'm able to sleep and get better sleep. It's amazing, you know, that as more information's coming out, I think we're going to see that more people are going to become educated on that. And we talk about it all the time with our clients. And I hope that the literature continues to support it, that more people are going to find that valuable and just their eating, the time that they eat, not being too close to bedtime. We've talked on other podcasts about blue light and TV and computers. There's all these little, what we call hacks, but they're really just best practice as far as, you know, how do we sleep well? And the stress of nutrition is something that can affect sleep. And sometimes people just don't tie it together.
The other thing I would point out, because you did mention obesity, and I don't think in my answer I really hit that. I think just COVID and the data on COVID and obesity shows you how much of a stressor poor eating is, to the point where you can't fight off a pathogen such as COVID or many other viruses as effectively as somebody else, because your body is, you know, many reasons with obesity, but mainly because you're fueling it with not good food, right? With garbage for the most part, and your immune system is down. So showing food as a positive stressor, we just kind of just highlighted, but that's a pretty concrete example, in my opinion, of food as a negative stressor that people that are eating really poorly.
Yeah. We've shared some data this week from just some stuff that's coming out. And I think that we're going to see a lot more of that in the next couple of years, that, you know, how food closely correlates to how your body defends and supports your immune response. So we'll dig into that on another podcast. I want to circle back a little bit, and you did a good job explaining the acute stress load, and we talked about acute stress load. What happens when a stress load becomes a chronic condition, which is usually the case? It builds up over a period of time. It becomes this chronic stressor you may not even realize is there the whole time. Tell me what the body's going through, and, you know, how an individual could recognize, or what signs or symptoms occur due to the chronic stress load that the body's under.
Yeah, those are a little bit harder to manage, but because the body will positively adapt or do its best to adapt for as long as possible, right? So you may not notice it until you'll undergo an injury, but it's kind of similar signs and symptoms to what we experience, right? It could be that you're not performing as well as you normally would, right? So whether it be mental performance or physical performance, like the exercises that I used to do that felt easy, the weight that I used to squat that used to be easy is no longer. I'm hitting a kind of a burnout. That chronic stressor has kind of caught up to me. Or it gets to the point where then you are injured. Mentally, I'm not as sharp as I used to be. I used to be able to problem solve and answer these questions on the fly. I'm finding that my processing is a lot slower. Communication, I'm not connected with some of the relationships that I'm in. I'm not, you know, really finding any value or connection there. So it could be a, you know, sensation of a lack of interest in certain things. So there's many different things. I think the chronic stressors are the ones that are harder to manage, in the sense that, you know, we don't know about them sometimes until injury or performance, you know, or emotional relationships, just like a lack of vigor in life kind of kicks in, and then we notice them. But it's at times, sometimes it's a little bit too late, right? So
or,
I think,
or a poor checkup with your doctor, and they say your blood pressure's up, or your heart rate's up, or some other metric that they're looking at, blood panel is up, that your body's actually internally responding, but you're not quite aware of it because it sneaks up on you.
Yeah. And that's where, like, a lot of the blood panels have been so much more robust. Like, we use like HbA1c in one of the lectures that we talked about with some of the staff. Like, if your HbA1c, so that's just the metric that looks at how your body is processing sugar, simplistically. But so if your HbA1c is, you know, elevated, you can become pre-diabetic or diabetic. But often that isn't elevated until you're in that pre-diabetic or diabetic state. And there's other markers, like insulin sensitivity is a marker that you can look at in your blood that's a little bit more sensitive to like short-term changes. So if you're getting blood paneling done once a year and waiting for it to be off, you know, or it's a little bit elevated, maybe you can intervene at like a 3 to 4 month window to say, okay, let's look at a different metric. And that's just one example. There's many examples with cholesterol and, you know, not just looking at one number, but looking at more robust numbers. So I think even the blood panels are being built out to say, if we're looking at everything historically, those are like chronic stressors and we're not addressing them until someone's sick. But are there more more measurables that we can look at to see how those small little stressors are affecting them before it becomes symptomatic, so that we could be preventative in our healthcare model?
Yeah, I like the direction we're going with blood panels. And I feel like every year when I do my check-in with my doctor, it's a different panel based on whatever science is coming out. And we're learning more and more. I'm kind of someone who likes to be informed as things are happening, so I don't get to that point where it's broken already and then I have to fix it. So I think the panel's getting more detailed. As a consumer though, and as a client, a patient, you know, I don't know that enough healthcare practitioners, doctors, whoever's running the test are, you know, moving outside of the generic panel yet. And I think more and more people will with time. And I'm kind of optimistic that that's going to be the way things are going to change in the future and really help streamline and funnel it down. So if a physician can pick that data up early enough and educate the consumer to say, here's some steps to take action on this, and not just say you have this condition, but go to a physical therapist, have them design a program, go to a trainer, have them go to an exercise physiologist, go to a nutritionist. And we as healthcare practitioners can really help develop educate and then put that into action for the client so they can actually see positive results. I think that's where things are trending. And I know that's the direction we're going. So,
and I think it's the direction that the consumer is going to go. And that's what drives every industry is the consumer. And healthcare is no different. Like, it's a consumer driven industry and there's more knowledge now than ever. So I think as people demand it and request it, then it'll happen.
Good stuff. Well, this is a good chat. We could definitely talk for hours on this. And I think we'll circle back in the next couple months. Get some more of these topics.
Sounds good. Good to have you back.
Thanks.
Thanks everyone for tuning in to another episode. If you liked the episode, please leave a review and please subscribe. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Optimal Health Uncovered. If you have questions for us or want to hear about something specific in an upcoming episode, send an email to podcast@performance-pt.com and be sure to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for more tips on optimal health. Until next time, be well.